that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Go, give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it?
Let's go, give it to you.
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up.
Order now at Acura.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whether thou art a ghost that hath come from the earth, or a phantom of night that hath no body, or one that lieth dead in the desert, or a ghost unburied, or a demon, or a ghoul, whatever thou be, until thou art removed, thou shalt find here no water to drink. Thou shalt not stretch forth thy hand to our own. Into our house enter thou not. Through our fence break through thou not. We are protected, though we may be frightened. Our life you may not steal, though we may be scared to death.
Welcome to Scared to Death, Creeps, Peepers, Roberts, and Annabelles. I'm Dan.
Hello, Dan. I'm Lindsay.
Lindsay Lou. And Lindsay Lou has just a quick charity announcement, and then we are off and running today.
I know. I love it. Let's get right to it. Okay, so this month's charity, for those of you who listen to both shows, you know that over on TimeSuck this month, Dan covered a cult that convinced people that being thin was the way to eternal life. Mm-hmm. And that, coupled with my own eating disorder and body dysmorphia, led us to donating to Project Heal this month, a nonprofit working to, quote, break down healthcare and financial barriers to eating disorder healing. And just like a few things, like just because this is like very, very important to me, but just some facts. I don't know if you guys knew this, but eating disorders are the second most fatal mental illness, second only to opioid use disorder. And every 52 minutes, a person dies as the result of an eating disorder. And so for me, as someone who towed that line very closely, I can tell you personally how very serious and very scary eating disorders are. So this month, the donation will be for $12,465. And if you or someone you love is in need of support, or if you just want to learn more about what Project Heal is up to, please visit theprojectheal.org.
Nice.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a really, really comprehensive website. And yeah, just like I was telling Dan, like, you know, when I was in the throes of my eating disorder, we definitely didn't have money for treatment because the solution was like, oh, just send them to a treatment facility. And it's like, that's not an option. And to this day, it's still very difficult to get health insurance to cover eating disorder treatment. So places like this really, really matter, especially for those of us that don't have just piles of money to throw at it.
So thank you. Thank you. And now what fan-submitted horror do you have for us today?
Yes. Well, this week I am offering you three stories.
Okay.
So my first story is a tale about house-sitting, being in someone else's home and experiencing something. And then my second tale is about something that we've all had, childhood nightmares. But the fun part is that it gets confirmed later, like, oh shit, I wasn't just a kid making things up. And then my third tale comes from an Indonesian woman telling us a tale about a possible attachment. And I just like that it's has some new characters. I was like, oh, I didn't know what that was.
Oh, all right. I look forward to hearing those.
I hope you do.
I have two tales that both involve quite a bit of historical setup.
Gross.
But I think very interesting history and pretty dark history. I'm all over the world today. In my first story, we're going to head to Tasmania to examine the history and haunted lore of Australia's infamous Port Arthur prison complex. A lot of atrocities seems to have led to a lot of spirits haunting what's now a historical site that offers tours, including nighttime ghost tours.
Did everybody immediately go, come to Tasmania, come to Tasmania?
No idea what that is.
Logan?
I'm blanking, sorry.
The Tasmanian Devil, that's like his whole little like thing.
Oh.
Come to Tasmania, come to Tasmania.
Huh. Yeah, okay. I don't remember him saying that though. Sorry. Oh,
it was the theme song.
In my second story, we're going to head to the Huelma building in downtown Sao Paulo, Brazil. Did a deadly fire in 1974 start because of a curse and lead to a haunting? So once you've showcased your spoopy socks this week, I'll get started.
Okay, well, I have two quick things. I'm showing you, again, just one spoopy socks, mm-hmm. one spoopy sock. You fancy bitch. I'll put it on in a second. And then just really quick before you go, we got the cutest fan.
Stained glass.
Look at this. I think this is like an example of Tiffany glass, if I'm not mistaken. And thank you to Alora at Down the Line Design. We get so many incredible gifts.
Yeah, we're so lucky.
We're so grateful. We would love to showcase them all. But this one was on my desk when I came in this morning or this afternoon. I was like, oh my God. I can't wait to show this to Penny and Ginger. They're just going to sit at and stare and bark because they're afraid of their own reflection. So thank you so much, Alora, and everyone who sends in amazing, truly, talented gifts to us. We appreciate
it. So much.
It. All right, let's go.
1830. That year, Sir George Arthur was sent to Van Diemen's Land, now the Australian state of Tasmania, to build another prison for the British colony. Van Diemen's Land was the name given to Tasmania when Dutch explorers claimed the island in 1642. They named it to honor Antony van Diemen, Governor General of the Dutch East Indies. In 1823, Sir Arthur had been appointed the Lieutenant Governor of the territory, arriving on the ship Adrian with his wife and family. And the territory, of course, now belongs to the UK at this point. At the time, the area was already a penal colony, but Sir Arthur was tasked with building a more severe prison complex, a place where the most hardened offenders, people who had typically initially committed crimes in England or Ireland before being sent to Australia where they reoffended, would be sent to suffer. It had been decided that Tasmania was the perfect location for such a place. It's a large island, 26th largest in the world, about 150 miles south of the Australian state of Victoria, separated from the continent by the relatively shallow Bass Strait, whose high ocean floor helps to create wave swells that will often reach approximately 60 feet in height. And they have wrecked literally hundreds of ships and drowned thousands of sailors over the past few centuries. Traveling to or from Tasmania in the 19th century was a frightening prospect for any traveler, convict or not. The area's isolation and its small population, due to much of the island being very rugged and mountainous, still only has less than 600,000 people today.
Wow.
Even though it's the same size as Sri Lanka, which has over 20 million people, is why Tasmania was chosen for Sir Arthur's new prison. There, convicts would labor out of sight and out of mind from most of the rest of Australia's population on the mainland, a population that would very likely never see any of the convicts should they try to escape, thanks to the island prison being surrounded by rough and shark-infested waters. Sir George Arthur would name his prison complex Port Arthur, named after himself, of course. A century and a half later, Port Arthur will be the site of Australia's greatest post-colonial tragedy, when a lone gunman, Martin Bryant, killed 35 people and wounded 23 others. Most of Bryant's victims were killed at the now historic site of Sir Arthur's old prison complex. The first to die tragically in the area, however, would not be Australian convicts or British colonizers. One of Sir Arthur's first acts in office was to give settlers legal immunity to kill any and all members of the local Aboriginal population.
What?
An insane and despicable mandate that kicked off what became known as the Black War.
Oh my God, I've never heard about this.
Yeah, a war many modern historians consider to be an attempt at genocide. Sir Arthur's brutal decree, he would soon even take it further and pay actual bounties for proof of Aboriginals who had been killed.
Oh my God.
Was prompted by the rapid spread of British settlers and agricultural livestock throughout areas of Tasmania that had long been traditional Aboriginal hunting grounds. In response, many Aboriginals had been attacking colonial settlers and convicts, attacks motivated by a desire for revenge after years of European atrocities that included the widespread kidnapping, rape, and murder of Aboriginal women and girls by convicts, settlers, and soldiers alike. The attacks were also carried out of desperation and starvation. Aboriginal forested hunting grounds were shrinking, native game was disappearing, and the dangers of hunting on open ground were growing thanks to more and more conflicts with colonizers. In response to local indigenous people defending themselves, Sir Arthur effectively ordered their extermination. During the Black War, nearly 1,000 Aboriginals would be killed, and most of those who weren't killed were sent to a place known as the Aboriginal Establishment, better categorized today as an internment camp, where Sir Arthur initially sent used blankets without any instructions to clean them, and an assistant overseer who had syphilis.
Oh my God.
Soon, between the blankets being infected with various viruses, Aboriginal people had no immunity for, and due to syphilis and overall abuse and mistreatment, people were dying in droves. The mortality rate for Aboriginals climbed to over 75% of the local population. Then, to cover his own ass, Arthur lied about this mortality rate and distanced himself from the atrocities he was responsible for by setting up a committee called the Aborigines Committee and putting them in charge of dealing with the, quote, problem of the Aboriginals. Now he could blame this committee for any sins that he had actually set in motion. The committee continued the horrible mistreatment of locals, its overseers ignoring any measures that would have saved them, like giving them condoms, which they did give to British convicts and sailors. Finally, over the next several years, around 200 more Aboriginals were forcibly relocated to two smaller islands in Bass Strait, Flinders and Hunter Island, from which any escape was deemed to be impossible. After having broken the collective back of the local native population, Sir George Arthur now turned his savage impulses towards the convicts. His prison would be designed according to contemporary English philosopher Jeremy Bentham's penal plans for a panopticon, a circular-shaped building where all the prisoners could be continuously observed simultaneously by a single corrections officer, giving the inmates no privacy, very little humanity, and saving Sir Arthur's government a lot of money. His prison was taking inmates by 1833 and was fully completed by 1855. Once finished, the overall shape of the prison was that of a cross, with an exercise yard at each end. The prisoner wings were all connected to the surveillance corps in the center of the prison, as well as the chapel in the center hall. And prisoners in all of the wings would suffer, both psychologically and physically. Food would be used to reward well-behaved prisoners and would be taken away as punishment for troublemakers. As a reward, a prisoner could receive larger amounts of food or even luxury items such as tea, sugar, and tobacco. As punishment, the prisoners would only receive a bare, not quite starvation level, but close minimum of stale and sometimes moldy bread and water that might be kind of clean. A torturous so-called silent system was also implemented to control prisoners. Prisoners would be forced to wear sensory deprivation hoods and made to stay silent. This was done in theory to allow time for prisoners to reflect upon the actions which had brought them there. But these hoods did not reap any rehabilitative benefits. They did, however, drive many of the prisoners at Port Arthur completely mad. And then, to more properly house these new mentally unwell prisoners, an asylum was built next door to the prison. Physical punishment would also increase under Sir Arthur. While his predecessors had not used capital punishment at all, Arthur would execute 260 people during his term in office from 1823 to 1836, leaving some bodies hanging and rotting for months in full view of all as a warning to other convicts to not repeat the actions of the dead. The sheer amount of work itself could also be considered a form of violence at the complex. Port Arthur began as a timber camp. The location was rich with forests and close enough to Tasmania's main port to ship out the timber. After 15 years, the prison built a shipyard and began constructing ships constructed by the convicts. Prisoners also produced flour from the mill and made nails, bricks, and boots, all to ensure the prison was profitable. They toiled through hard labor, regardless of their age or physical condition, day after day with little time for rest and often barely enough food to keep them alive. Life at Port Arthur was bleak, to say the least. Bleak enough to motivate convicts to want to escape, but the only way to the mainland, once out of your cell and on some sort of work assignment, was to first get past armed guards, half-starved dogs, and a variety of man-made traps. Also, shore-based and ship-based whaling had been banned in the area to prevent convicts trying to escape in boats. Contact between visiting seamen and prisoners was banned. Ships had to check thoroughly before departing and again upon landing outside of Port Arthur, their contents, to prevent unwittingly aiding in any escapes. And then there was the brutal Bass Strait to deal with. Despite all these natural and man-made safeguards, many attempts at escape were made, and some were even successful. A few convicts occasionally seized boats, made it not only to the Australian mainland, but all the way back to England or Ireland.
Damn!
Many of those who escaped reported having received savage beatings and being forced into brutal chain gangs in Tasmania, saying that Port Arthur was hell on earth. One such man was Martin Cash. Born in Ireland, it's just a fun little side road. Born in Ireland at the age of 18, he'd shot a man named Jessup for making advances on his girlfriend. First sent to become an indentured servant in Australia, he was initially assigned to work on a ranch, but after supposedly unwittingly participating in a cow thieving scam, he was remanded to Port Arthur. He briefly would escape Port Arthur twice before being recaptured, once after swimming in shark-infested waters. Then on December 26, 1842, Cash escaped a third time with fellow convicts George Jones and Lawrence Cavanaugh while working outside the prison complex. The trio hid in the woods, waded through water with their clothes tied in bundles above their heads, robbed a road gang's hut for clothing, and began an 8-month spree of bushranging robbing Tasmanian mail coaches, homesteads, and inns.
Damn.
Cash soon heard that another girlfriend, this one named Bessie, was shacking up with some dude in the town of Hobart, Tasmania, and enraged, he swore he'd kill them both.
Oh, boy.
He was spotted, and in a shootout with police, he killed Constable Peter Withstanley, for which he was sentenced to death by hanging and sent back to Port Arthur. However, his sentence would somehow be commuted at the last minute, and then he'd go on to become a trustee, and later a constable himself after he was freed. Subsequently, he traveled to New Zealand in 1860, where he ran several brothels, then made it back to Tasmania, living as a free man, dying in 1877 at the age of 69 after living quite the insane life. He never was imprisoned again at Port Arthur after having his execution commuted.
What an interesting guy.
Most sent to Port Arthur, not nearly so lucky. Many never left the prison alive, including a lot of children imprisoned there. Port Arthur became a destination for a lot of juvenile Australian convicts, receiving many boys, some young as 9.
Oh my God.
Like the adults, the boys were used in hard labor, such as stone cutting, construction, subjugated to many of the same harsh punishments, psychological and physical. Life was so bad that some prisoners, both adult and juvenile, were said to have committed murders, an offense punishable by quick death, just to escape the prospect of spending their life in Port Arthur. Those who did die were often buried on the aptly named Isle of the Dead. The tiny 2.5-acre island became the primary destination for all convicts, old and young alike, who died at Port Arthur. Of the 1,646 graves recorded to exist there, there's probably a lot more bodies than that, only 180, those of prison staff and military personnel, were ever marked. Finally, the prison would close in 1877, and unsurprisingly, many say that there still exists a lot of paranormal remnants of all the former brutality at Port Arthur today. Time now for the tale of the ghosts of Port Arthur. I'll begin with the oldest structure at Port Arthur, the Commandant's House. The large white brick building was built for the prison director, also called the Commandant. Set on a slight incline, the house overlooked the bay and the entire prison complex, and its many horrors. Visitors have reported seeing the Commandant's rocking chair located on the building's front porch, rhythmically moving back and forth, perfectly empty, as though someone is still obsessively watching over the colony all these years later. Still others have reported that if they try to take a picture of the chair, the cameras malfunction, or the picture turns out mysteriously dark, even on a bright sunny day, as if whatever unseen entity is still sitting in it doesn't want to risk being revealed somehow. Behind the Commandant's house is arguably the most haunted building in the colony, the church. To build the church, unsurprisingly, Port Arthur found free labor in his prisoners. And some of those prisoners would die during its construction, not always from illness or exhaustion. On December 16, 1835, poor Joseph Shuttleworth found himself in the wrong place at the wrong time while he was helping to build the church at Port Arthur. Shuttleworth was digging a trench when a fellow convict named William Riley, seemingly out of nowhere, violently struck him on the head with a pickaxe. And then he hit him again and again and again, splattering the walls around them with blood. When he was done, he placed the pickaxe down and whispered, "I am satisfied." Shuttleworth was taken to the hospital, where incredibly he was initially quite lucid. However, he soon started convulsing and eventually, never recovering, he died. Riley was hanged for his murder. Although the blood was washed from the walls, the ivy, which would later grow so freely over the rest of the church, would curiously never grow where the man's blood had been spilt. And for many years now, residents of Port Arthur have reported seeing strange figures in the church's bell tower at night, despite the fact that there are no stairs up to the bell tower. The bells that are now stationary on the ground have been known to ring out randomly. Perhaps it's the ghost of Shuttleworth ringing out for help. Across from the church is a street with a series of houses called Officer's Row. It was where the most senior prison officials lived, the houses conspicuously separate from the rest of the complex, to make it seem as though the officers and their families were not inmates themselves. But the work-life boundary would become less distinct in at least one house. That house belonged to the surgeon, and his dissection room was located in his basement. In this room, inmates' dead bodies were opened up and examined, not just for routine autopsies, but supposedly for experiments as well. And there are rumors that sometimes live prisoners were taken to the surgeon's house for sadistic experiments. Walking into the old dissection room today, the temperature seems to drop drastically, far more than it should fall in an underground basement. What's more, people have reported seeing what looks like human eyes staring at them from inside the walls somehow, and bloody faces appearing from within the walls as well, only to disappear after a few moments. Perhaps these are the wrong prisoner's spirits still feeling tormented in the old doctor's dissection room basement that was perhaps more of a dungeon and torture chamber than anything related to the actual study of medicine. Next, there is the asylum. As said before, the asylum was home to prisoners who were too mentally ill to remain imprisoned in the general population. And now the ghosts of some former prisoners are said to haunt its ruins. But the two most infamous ghosts of the asylum are not former prisoners, but instead the ghosts of a young girl and an older woman often seen roaming the halls together. How? After the prison closed in 1877, the asylum building was refurbished and turned into a school. No one seems to know why this teacher and her apparent pupil haunt these halls today, only that the apparition of a woman dressed like a teacher from the 19th century, seen with the apparition of a young girl who looks like her student, has been witnessed by numerous people on different occasions. The former hospital is also haunted. The hospital once contained an arcade and an open balcony where convalescing patients were once allowed to walk. It could accommodate up to 80 patients and was often staffed by just one doctor, assisted by various untrained convict orderlies. And these men would assist the doctor in performing gruesome surgeries without anesthesia. One of these surgery recipients was a convict named Edward Howard. Howard tried to escape Port Arthur, but was shot through the upper arm, the bullet smashing through bone, and then apprehended. He was taken to the hospital, where the doctor dislocated his shoulder and then amputated his arm just below the joint. The doctor then cauterized the severely bleeding remains of his limb with a hot frying pan. And Howard was sent back to work on a chain gang 2 weeks later.
The fuck?
He may still think he's working on the grounds of Port Arthur. A shadowy, one-armed apparition has been reportedly witnessed walking around the site of the old hospital. The hospital was abandoned after Port Arthur closed in 1877. It was eventually purchased by the Catholic Church, who converted it into a boys' home. And I wonder, did those boys hear any screams from the ghosts of those who'd suffered and also often died on the surgeon's table? Screams said to still be heard on the old hospital grounds today. Did the same ghostly figures that some have claimed to see and hear in recent years wander through their bedrooms searching for lost limbs, crying out in agony at the pain? Speaking of boys, one of the saddest stories from the site's former days housing juvenile offenders is that of a young boy who was sentenced to death. Today, people report hearing the cries of a young boy at night, just like the cries he was said to have made leading right up to his execution, begging for his life to be spared. Arguably, the former prison's complex's most famous ghost is that of William Carpenter. William was 27 and a farm laborer from Essex when he was sentenced to the silent system. Only allowed to walk outside covered with a hood, sentenced to solitary confinement otherwise, William soon began looking for a way out and found it. He hanged himself in his cell in 1867 after carving the word solitary suicide into the wall. If you ever decide to visit Port Arthur for a tour, you might pause in front of a door to his cell in the so-called separate prison. Visitors have reported the feeling of overwhelming sadness after stepping inside, as if his spirit is still lingering there. One visitor was so paralyzed with emotion that they were found by others on their tour, lying in the fetal position in the corner of William's old cell, sobbing, and they had to be carried out. Finally, the Isle of the Dead is also, not surprisingly, supposedly haunted. What I didn't mention when talking about this little island before was that various prisoners were assigned to work on the island as a resident gravedigger. They were forced to live alone on the Isle of the Dead in a small wooden hut. Mark Jeffrey was the most infamous of all Port Arthur's gravediggers. He was accused of manslaughter and sent to Port Arthur directly from Ireland. And one day, after seeing smoke billowing up from a fire on the Isle of the Dead, some guards went to see what was happening and found the hut burned to the ground, and Jeffrey standing nearby, babbling nonsensically. The gravedigger begged the guards to take him back with them to the main prison complex, saying the devil had appeared to him, destroyed his hut, and left him half sane. He was taken back to the main complex and imprisoned in the asylum. After his death, he seems to have possibly returned to the Isle of the Dead, where his spirit can still be allegedly heard babbling about the devil and God knows what else. Today, the former Port Arthur convict settlement lies mostly in ruins, and has been in ruins for well over a century. As the Hobart Mercury, a paper published not too far away, proclaimed in the late 1880s, the buildings themselves are fast going to decay, and in a few years will attract nobody, for they will be ruined without anything to make them worthy of respect or even remembrance. The new residents of the Port Arthur area were glad to see the old buildings crumbling, wishing to distance themselves from the area's dark past. After the penal settlement at Port Arthur closed in 1877, the land was auctioned off and the site was renamed Carnarvon. Yeah, Carnarvon, no longer there, and not to be confused with the small city of the same name in Western Australia. In 1895 and 1897, fires swept through the new township and reduced to ruins many of the old buildings, including the hospital, the penitentiary, and the so-called separate prison. Today, the ruins are a historic site, and you can buy a ticket to partake in a variety of interesting tours, including a nighttime ghost tour if you're feeling brave.
Nope. Nope. Nope.
It looks really cool, actually, the way they do the tour. I'll show a little picture later.
It's too much death there. Too much sadness.
Yeah, a lot. And it's crazy that that site, after all of that, years later became the site of, like, by far Australia's worst post-colonial tragedy in the sense of a mass shooter, like, just killed people right there on those grounds, too, because it's not a populated area. Yeah, it's just crazy, all the history in that one spot.
It's just, like, a deeply dark place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes you just can't rehabilitate a place. It just, you know, after it all goes to shit and it's all gone, I bet the people of that area aren't going to be like, let's build a development there. It's probably just going to be like, let's try and plant some trees.
Yeah, it's a historic site now, so they're just going to keep it, the ruins as are.
Oh, it's like a protected.
Protected site now. Yeah, it looks pretty. I mean, this first picture, this is a lovely shot of the ruins of the former Port Arthur prison complex.
Oh, is not what I was expecting.
Right? Looks lovely.
Looks like a freaking castle.
I know, it looks like a vacation destination. Looks beautiful.
Okay. I was picturing something, I don't know, much more drab maybe the word that I want.
Yeah. And back then, like the way it was isolated, I couldn't figure out if it ever had like a big fence around it or walls. I don't think it did. I think, you know, it's like, you know, you were imprisoned in your cells and there were always guards with the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, yeah, if you escaped into the rest of Tasmania, they would just round you up.
Like you were saying, there was nowhere to go.
Yeah. I mean, it's not
I can't believe that one guy escaped three times.
I know. And I can't.
Shark infested waters. Like, what?
If this was Time Suck, I would have went much deeper on him. And like, how the hell did you escape execution?
You should do a little short suck
maybe on the guy.
Yeah, he sounds like a nut. In a fun way. Entertaining, educational way.
People oftentimes forget, but like for Western fans, you know, like we had our Wild West here in this country. Australia had arguably an even wilder West.
Oh, really?
Like in the 19th century, they had little like boom towns and bush, and they had these people called bush, they referred to them as bush rangers.
Uh-huh.
They were just like bandits.
Okay.
They just lived that outlaw life, but over there, very similar to cowboys of the Wild West,
getting
in shootouts and all kinds of stuff, but with an accent. this next one's a photo submitted to the UK's Daily Mail.
The only difference, just an accent.
This is of an alleged apparition captured
in that
on
window?
Film. Yep, you can see the face in that little window at bottom left.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll go to one more photo where it's been like they circled it, you know, look a little closer.
Yeah, I saw like a white spot. I don't know if I see a face.
I feel like I see the eyes, the nose. It's like a face looking.
Oh, I see it. Like a profile. Like a mm-hmm. side profile.
And maybe the hint of their shoulders and body below.
Okay. If you wouldn't have said that, I just saw like a weird white blob. But now that you point out the,
yeah,
you know, like
the,
that kind
the,
of-
the
like,
profile?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's-
It almost looks like the Phantom of the Opera mask.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
He starts singing.
So here's a picture of the complex in the 1870s, right before it got shut down. I mean, it does look really quaint when you just see it across the water there.
I know. If you told me that that was a hotel in some little fishing village, mm-hmm. I'd be like, oh, that looks great.
Yeah, it looks awesome.
Yeah.
Here's a postcard from 1926 depicting what life had been like for the prisoners.
Ugh.
Bunch of guys working together to plow a field, chained together, while a guard with some sort of big stick watches them. I'm sure he was not...
Do you see there's something at the... At the end of his stick, there's a rope with something at the end of it.
Oh, that's probably he was whipping him.
Yeah, I'm not sure what was at the end of that, but
something to
long distance whipper.
It almost looks like there's a guy in the very back with a plow.
Oh, there sure is.
They're using them as manpower.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Oh, those, yeah.
Yeah, that line of guys, they're the mules.
Man, we don't know hard labor. Not like that.
Mm-hmm. Finally, here's some people on a ghost tour of Port Arthur, and I love that they give them lanterns.
I don't know how I feel about that.
That'd be so cool.
They're probably just Coleman's. I'm sure it's fine. I doubt that they're...
Oh, yeah, not like a little flame, like a whale oil or something. But I just love the thought of being able to go on a ghost tour. Like, it's dark, there's no lights, like, have no lights come on, no electric lights, and then you just have this little lantern. It would just really add to the spooky factor.
I mean, it's great for production value.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me want to go even less. La.
That's all I got.
Okay, that was really interesting. We don't get a lot of tails out of Australia. I mean, we have like a decent amount, but not a ton. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the first time we've been to Tasmania, to that state.
Come to Tasmania.
Now we're going to go to a country, I think I've told a story from there before, but I'm not positive. I'm pretty sure, but very rarely. Do you want to go to Brazil?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I feel like we were in Brazil with like a, something about two police officers, and I think in the end he threw himself off the edge of a cliff or something. It was a story that you told.
Oh, I know what you're talking about, and I feel like that was in Peru or something. It was South America, I think, but I don't think Brazil. I don't think.
Me and Brazil, we don't really get along.
You want to return there for a story, though?
I guess.
Before we head to Sao Paulo, we need to first take a quick in-between story sponsor break. What is the most basic gift you have ever given the moms in your life for Mother's Day? Flowers? A candle? Some random knickknack you picked up at the last minute because you completely spaced Mother's Day?
I have definitely made the mistake of procrastinating gifts for Mother's Day, and then, like the Friday before, I run to whatever store is open and convince myself that, yes, yes, my mom does need another coffee mug that declares she's the world's best. So lame.
This year, how about one upping yourself by giving the moms in your life an Aura picture frame? Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to any mom at any age. Aura frames connect easily to Wi-Fi and have unlimited storage so you can share as many pictures as you want.
This year, as many of you know, I am on a spending freeze, but one of my carve-outs was meaningful gifts for the people I love. I don't want to give all of the moms in our lives something that won't bring them joy. We are giving Aura frames to the moms in our world because they are timeless, heartwarming gifts.
Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code SCARED at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Next, I'll give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience.
Acura wins Daytona!
And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it?
Let's go, give it to you!
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up!
Order now at Acura.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Thanks for listening to our sponsors, Creeps and Peepers. Hope you heard an appealing deal and used our landing pages or discount codes to save yourself some money. The Huelma building is a 25-story high-rise in downtown Sao Paulo, Brazil. Or was. It's been renamed. The building was completed in 1971, stood for just 3 years before needing to be largely rebuilt, and then reopened later as the renamed Flag Square building. On February 1st, 1974, an air conditioning unit overheated and started a fire, a massive fire, and the entire building would be engulfed in flames within just 20 minutes. 756 bank employees were working inside the building that day, and at least 179 of them died.
Damn.
Some bodies were never found, and around another 300 were injured. The Huelma fire, still one of the worst skyscraper fires in history, I think third most deadly.
Crazy.
The interior of the building was furnished with flammable items such as wooden furniture, curtains, and carpets. There were no emergency lights, fire alarms, sprinkler systems, or emergency exits in the building at the time of the fire. When the fires began to spread, anyone inside the upper levels had only two reasonable means from which to escape: the elevators or the one common stairwell that ran the full height of the building. There was a third option that sadly many people felt they had no chance but to take: jumping from a window, the roof, or a balcony. Sadly, the fire could have easily been avoided. The air conditioning unit on the 12th floor that started the fire needed a special circuit breaker that was unavailable at the time of installation. Instead of waiting for it, the unit was activated by bypassing the 12th floor control panel. And then over the next several years, the circuit breaker it needed for proper functioning was just never installed.
Oh, cool. No, great.
And at 8:50 a.m. in the morning of February 1st, 1974, the unit finally short-circuited and overheated. An individual in another building first reported the fire when they saw smoke. First responders arrived at 9:10 a.m., 20 minutes after the fire began. They requested backup, which arrived by 9:30, but traffic jams prevented them from getting there as fast as they normally would have been able to. By that time, the flames had almost reached the roof and had already blocked off the building's only stairwell. The fire never spread past the 15th floor because of a lack of flammable material in the stairwell. The first responders' ladders could only reach the 14th floor, and the fire department vehicles tragically had no water when they arrived to dampen the roaring flames. Everyone trapped in the upper floors could not use the stairs because of the smoke and the heat, and firefighters could not ascend past the 11th floor. About 300 employees were evacuated before conditions worsened, and more people escaped using the elevators. Clara Lucia Diaz Gomez was one of the first people to smell smoke.
Good job, buddy.
And flee the building. She was quoted as saying, "When I got there, the flames were already racing up through the building. Already people were jumping from the windows." A secretary who was trapped on the upper floors but survived said, "We went through the unimaginable, from trying to shrink to hide from the flames as they licked the ceiling to using dead bodies to protect us from the fire. It was Dante's hell." Many remaining employees climbed onto balconies. 171 people went to the roof. A helicopter rescue was attempted, but there wasn't enough landing space. 80 people hiding under tiles on the roof were luckily found alive after the fire burned out. However, many of them were badly burned and otherwise injured. Of the 40 individuals who jumped, all died immediately on impact.
Damn.
A group of 13 people who tried to escape in the elevators died of smoke inhalation, and then their bodies were burned beyond recognition. Their blackened corpses were found huddled together in a final group embrace. They were never conclusively identified and were buried together in a large plot called the 13 Souls Grave in the São Pedro Cemetery. This tragedy would lead to increased fire safety regulations throughout the world. The Huelma building was closed for 4 years for reconstruction, and rumors of ghost sightings first started during the rebuilding process. Time now for the tale of a fire and a curse. One of the survivors of the fire was a man named Alvaro, who worked in the building with his brother, Volkimar. Volkimar died of asphyxiation from smoke inhalation. In 1979, Alvaro decided to turn his brother's story into a film, and production was continually interrupted by paranormal occurrences. For example, after filming the death scene, one of the photographers noticed that the camera had captured images of people who were not members of the cast or crew. In 2004, part of Sao Paulo City Hall moved into the old Huelma building, a move some initially resisted. Numerous members of the mayor's staff refused to enter the building until a Buddhist monk performed a purification ceremony and deemed it safe. However, while the monk did feel the building was technically safe, this monk would later tell the network TV Globo that she could not do anything to calm the spirits inside the building. Various people who have been inside the skyscraper since before it was reopened after the fire have claimed to have seen numerous apparitions. In the parking area, some people have reportedly witnessed phantom cars whose lights flash repeatedly, or to have heard disembodied whispers or cries of pain and seen various ghosts. The São Pedro Cemetery, where the 13 unidentified victims are buried, receives thousands of visitors a year, and dozens of them every year seem to report hearing disembodied screaming or voices pleading for help. And now let's back up to the real reason some think the building caught fire, a curse. A curse that's existed since long before the high-rise was ever built. Decades before construction began on the Huelma building, there was a small house on the same plot of land. The homeowner was a 26-year-old chemistry professor named Paulo Ferreira de Camargo, who lived with his mom and two younger sisters. His mother, Benedita, suffered from cancer. His middle sister, Maria, had epilepsy. And Cordelia, the youngest sister, was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Jeez.
Because of their various medical conditions, Paulo was a frequent hospital visitor. And during one visit to the hospital, he met and fell in love with a nurse named Isoltina dos Amaros and was soon introduced to her family. Isoltina's mother accepted Paulo immediately and was overjoyed about his relationship with her daughter. She would later say in an interview with the local paper that she came to love him like a son. But Paulo's mother, Benedita, unfortunately did not feel the same way about Isoltina. She disapproved of her because she found out that she was not a virgin. She had been with another man outside of marriage.
Oh boy.
Which was taboo in this very Catholic city to many at this time in history. Because of this, Benedita believed that Isoltina was not worthy of her son. And she decided to make her life as difficult as possible by doing things like refusing to give the phone to Paulo when she called him when he was at home, and also refusing to tell him that she had called when he'd been away. and Paolo's sisters helped her because they too did not approve of Isoltina. When Paolo found out about what had been going on, he was furious. He opened up to Isoltina about how their serious health issues affected him, how tired he was of being around them all the time, having to take care of them. He also believed that as the man of the house and as their provider and caretaker, he should not be so disrespected. Isoltina now noticed a change in Paolo. He became withdrawn and depressed. Around this time, Paolo approached a young student at the university he taught at, named Benedito Camarco, no relation, and explained to him that he had brought a gun to school because he was conducting an experiment on the reverberation of sound. He asked Benedito to stand outside of one of the labs to see if the gun was audible when fired. Benedito agreed to his professor's strange requests and reported that, yes, he could still hear the gun, but the noise was greatly muffled. Shortly after that experiment, Paolo, satisfied with the results, dug a deep well in his backyard. As soon as that was completed, Paolo murdered his mother and both of his sisters. He walked through the house one night and shot them one by one, then threw their bodies down into the well and sealed it shut.
Holy crap.
His mother, Benedita, was shot twice in the chest and died almost instantly. His sister, Cordelia, was shot once in the back and a second time in the neck. She died of internal bleeding, likely after being thrown down the well. His other sister, Maria, was tied up before she was shot once in the neck and twice in the back. A few days after the murders, Paolo visited his friend, Jose Ramos Rosa, and asked to borrow a suitcase so he could take his mother and sisters on a little vacation. 3 days later, he mailed letters to Ramos Rosa, his girlfriend Isoltina, and others, informing them that, sadly, while on his trip, his mother and sisters had been killed in a terrible accident. A car they were riding in had fallen off a cliff. Paolo then contacted his half-brother Carlos and informed him what happened. Carlos paid him a visit as soon as he was back in Sao Paulo and was suspicious. Every time Paolo told him how his mother and sisters had died, the details were a bit different than the time he told the story before. He also had no death certificates for the women. Carlos went to the police with his suspicions, along with a neighbor who saw Paolo sealing off his well the night of the murders. The police came to search the house 19 days after the women had been killed. Paolo mockingly said to the officers when he answered the front door, "Do you gentlemen believe I'm insane? That I'm unhinged enough to have killed my mother and my sisters and buried them in my backyard? My house is all yours. Search it all you want." Once they entered, Paolo must have known he was going to soon be caught. He locked himself inside his bathroom and, using the same gun he'd murdered his mother and sisters with, shot himself in the heart. The police theorized that Paolo killed his mother and sisters because they would never approve of his relationship with Isoltina, and also because he was tired of taking care of them. Strangely, one of the firefighters who recovered the bodies from the well died of a rare infection just days later. His death is the origin story of the curse. The curse that some now began to believe, drove Paolo insane and led to him killing his family and then himself, the curse that led to the firefighter's death, and the curse that led to, decades later, nearly 500 people being injured or killed in a high-rise fire. Some who buy into this curse possibility believe that the land had been cursed for centuries, as it was the location of a pillory where numerous enslaved people were tortured and murdered by Portuguese colonizers. For those who point to this curse as the true source of numerous tragedies, they now wonder when the curse will strike next.
Did you say a pillory?
Yeah, it's like a...
So where you make pills?
No, it's like a stock. You know, like olden times, people would put their like head and hands through these holes, and then they would be like put on display for people and as a punishment.
Yeah.
It's a type of one of those.
Oh.
Where basically like people would be left out, whipped, you know, just tortured and stuff. And
Jesus.
Full public view.
Great. Glad I asked.
Yeah. But yeah, so two stories where like the land where the stories are set seems to have just been the site of, you know, many, many tragedies going back a long, long time.
Yeah.
I have some crazy pictures.
Okay, I bet you do.
One's very intense.
Okay.
So yeah, warning to anybody checking our socials, I guess, regarding these pictures. But this first one's a pic of the Huelma building taken in the early 70s before the fire. So that's how it looked after completion. This next picture is the Huelma building while burning February 1st, 1974.
Holy shit.
Yep, just engulfed in flames.
Jumping in the middle?
I'm not sure what that object is. It looks like it could be falling. Well, this next picture
is
somebody did capture someone in mid-jump. They jumped.
Oh, God.
Trying to catch that fireman's ladder below them. Several people would try that and no one made it.
Well, no, that wouldn't work.
Yeah, but just, you know, ultimate desperation.
I know, because I wrote down, like, would you jump?
Possibly, yes.
I think
once the flame started to lick me, yeah.
Right, what's the worst fate?
Yeah, like, I would rather die quickly on impact than to be burned up on the roof.
I would start taking really deep breaths and hope to God I pass out from smoke inhalation. Like if I knew that like my death was imminent.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing that some survived on the roof
and
in other places by like covering themselves with bodies or roof tiles or whatever. And they did make it.
Yeah. Wild.
In this final picture, the three murder victims that led to the curse, supposedly Paolo's mother and his two sisters.
All because his girlfriend was a dirty slut, huh?
I know. It is crazy. Just like the weird taboos of the day.
Mm-hmm.
That they would make that big of a deal of it. Like, who cares that she has a great job? She's helping people. She's a nurse. Who cares that Paolo loves her? Yeah. And they're just like, nope. We're just going to make your life hell as he's taking care of them.
I know.
Not that like it was okay for him to murder them.
No, not at all.
No, but it's like, but sometimes some people it's like, man, you were asking for somebody to like snap with you.
Right.
Like you were being such a dick. This person's taking care of you, taking you to all your appointments, providing a home for you. And then you're going to shit on their girlfriend.
I know you've been taking really good care of me.
Oh, I didn't even think
really
of that.
Polite. I've been so polite. I haven't complained once.
Yeah, that's all I got.
Yeah. Brazil's a crazy country. You know, you've never been there, right?
No, I've never been.
Yeah.
I know you've been, but yeah, not me.
Like immediately when you start talking about it, I just quickly very much flashed to like being in traffic there. And it was, I think you experienced this in South Africa, but like I had never Yes. It's like you come to a stop sign and then all of a sudden there's just people everywhere knocking on your windows, uh-huh, trying to sell you uh-huh. phone chargers and,
yep.
and umbrellas and bottles of water and candy. And I was like, what the fuck is happening? And I just remember, like, because we were with a group and they were like, do not roll your windows down. Do not make eye contact. Yeah. Do not engage. And then, it was just wild.
I
don't know.
Yeah.
And I was in like, sorry, just to finish that thought. I don't want to categorize all of Brazil that way,
sure,
but that was my experience in like
too.
The four cities.
Yeah.
I was in like four major cities.
Yeah, huge cities.
And that's all I walked away with was like, this place is insane.
And Sao Paulo is one of the biggest cities in the world. I think top three or four.
It's a crazy place.
Yeah. I experienced that in South. I remember in Johannesburg. And I'll never forget this one guy. It was so long ago now. But, you know, I got kind of used to it being over there. So I was there for like a month over in South Africa. And and people would come. And usually they would have like, you know, items that you might need. A bottle of water.
Yeah.
A bag of chips.
Yeah.
A phone charger. That kind of thing. And I'll never forget this one guy. He just had a big clock. and he appeared just to have one. He just, I saw him multiple times. Like, man,
Flava Flav?
You're just hoping for that clock payout. Just like, everything's riding on this clock.
It's like, that's Flava Flav's inspiration.
Yeah, it was just such a random thing. And not even a digital clock. Just like a big, round, what looked like an alarm clock, like an old school one you'd put on your nightstand. That, this is a while ago, but even at that time, it was like way dated. You know, everyone was—
I mean, I know you're old, but my God, it wasn't that long ago.
Everyone was already using like their cell phones for the most part to you know, wake up. And I was like, okay, that's an interesting business plan.
That's all he had.
That's all you could find.
I wonder if people would like try and like take a picture with him and then he would charge for photographs.
Maybe. Clock guy.
Know. Do you know clock guy?
Yeah, maybe.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, desperate times.
Mm-hmm.
Desperate times. Okay. Well, that's all I've got.
Oh, okay. Well, that was fun.
That was good.
Yeah.
It was great. I drank my little Italian soda.
Good job.
Got some sugar in my system. I'm trying to get off caffeine. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel like now it's like day like five that I've just been on decaf and I feel okay. I feel like I got over the hump.
Yeah. Yeah. Good job.
Yeah. Couple headaches, couple cranky moments, but I did all right. What Layla do you have this week?
I have a little pink Layla. Just
your
pink sweater.
We match.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's dive in, Daniel.
Okay.
Hey guys. Hello. I'm from South Central Texas, and I'm a non-denominational Christian. I have been sensitive to things for as long as I can remember. My mom always said it was because of my faith that was so strong, and that if anything scary ever happened, to just call out to God or Jesus and that I'd be okay. I've seen angels, red-eyed demons, ghosts, and one time I even saw an unidentified flying object. Whenever I have these experiences, it feels a lot like that feeling you get when someone is staring at you from across the room. You don't know why you have the urge to look up, you just do. And then you see it. The person, the angel, the demon, the ghost, or the strange light in the sky. This experience from 2017 still gives me chills. I personally think it was a demon, but I don't know for sure. I was in between apartments when a family friend was going out of town for 2 weeks, the exact amount of time I was without an apartment. She asked me to cat sit, and after telling her my situation, agreed to turn it into a full-on house-sitting gig. And I was happy to do it. I loved her cat, and it saved me from having to drive back and forth from my hometown an hour away to work every day. My family friend is also a non-denominational Christian, and she is one of the sweetest ladies you could ever meet. When I arrived at her house after work, it immediately felt off. I had an especially uneasy feeling towards the back corner where the guest room and bathroom were. I told myself that it was just because she wasn't there, and I wasn't used to being in her house without her. I took a shower, but felt uneasy the whole time, like someone was about to bust in at any minute. I was told I could sleep in the guest bed, but it made me so uncomfortable that I chose to sleep on the couch instead. I spread out the sleeping bag I had brought with me and set myself up facing the back door, keeping my back to the rest of the house. I left the lamp by the couch on and tried to lull myself to sleep with a boring game on my phone. It was about 1 a.m. when I eventually turned off the light, hating the fact that I didn't have any animals there to protect me. The cat was an inside-outside cat, and he didn't like being inside when his human wasn't home. I was used to having my dog with me to alert me to things, but she was back in my hometown until I could move into my new apartment. As I lied in the dark, I listened. New house, new noises. I heard a low hum start. That's the AC kicking on, I thought. I heard a pop. That's the wood adjusting to the change in the temperature, I told myself. That feeling I get when I'm being stared at came over me. I heard a small creak from the guest bedroom, as if someone were stepping on the hardwood floor and not from the expanding from the temperature shift. You're fine, you're fine, you're fine, I thought to myself. I turned myself into the couch, tucking my face in between the back cushion and my pillow. Another creak. It came from where the table was behind the love seat. I heard a small noise on the backside of the couch where my head was. A voice popped into my head. Whether it was mine or not, I do not know, but it said, "It's coming." I physically felt something bump the back of the couch near my feet, followed by a momentary silence, and then it pounced on me and it sat on my left ribs. It started pushing my head down into the couch so hard that it hurt. There was an intense ringing in my head that wouldn't let up. I need to call out to God, I thought. I tried to open my mouth, but as I did, a masculine voice in my head said, "Don't open your mouth. It will get inside of you." I kept my mouth closed and began praying as hard as I could. It felt like forever, but it couldn't have been much more than a minute before this thing was suddenly off of me. I sat up as fast as I could, reached for the light, looking around the living room, and of course, I saw nothing. I called my family friend, apologizing for the late hour, and explained what had happened. I put her on speakerphone, and she prayed over the house and over me. After getting off the phone with her, I did not go back to sleep. I put on Christian music and waited for 5 a.m. I got up, rolled up my sleeping bag into a messy wad, locked the house, and went to IHOP. I had my breakfast and then went to my job to sleep in my car for an hour before covering my 8-to-5 shift, feeling dead on my feet. I refused to spend any more nights there. I fed that cat every day and then made the hour-long drive to my parents and then back every day until my new apartment was ready. When I tell this story to my friends, they insist I had sleep paralysis. I can assure you, I did not. But if it makes them sleep better at night, then fine. Think what you want. Love, Peeper Gone Creeper.
I like Peeper Gone Creeper.
I know, it's cute.
Yeah, I always like to think about like the supposed rules of these. Okay, again, you know, going with like there was this entity.
Yeah.
And it was trying to get inside her. Pretty funny that like it would need to enter your mouth.
I know, I love that.
Uh-huh. I mean, and who knows? Like, we don't know anything about like, you know, these things, you know, like if they're real, it's like how they operate.
Yeah.
But that is interesting to think that like it could, you know, come over here. It could, you know, start to attack you. But like if you were just like keep your mouth closed,
yeah,
you can like fend it off. Or maybe just the thought of doing that, like the belief, the faith that that will work.
Mm, yeah.
Could like, you know, counteract what it's trying to do.
I was envisioning her like opening her mouth and how you kind of open your mouth and take a deep breath, or just like sucking in the demon.
Oof.
Like
I've seen that like sequence in horror movies. And
exactly.
It's so creepy.
It's so creepy because then you just imagine that demon like spreading out in their body and taking over.
Uh-huh.
And then it's just like, that's it. That's not that yeah. person anymore. It's now. How come they can't just go in through the ear? That's another open hole.
Oh, yeah, they would lead right to your brain.
Yep, be just as easy. Doesn't require any opening of anything. It's just an open door.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that. That would be like a fun twist in like a scene in a horror movie.
Oh my
God. Where the person's like, you know, fighting it off and they're closing their mouth and it looks like, you know, like this mist, this demonic mist, you know, it just stops.
Yeah.
But then it just kind of lifts and then it just goes to the side and then it just goes whoop, just right in their ear.
How come it doesn't go in your eyeballs? That would also be so creepy. Yeah. I was thinking about like how you get like, you know, a fleck of something in your eye, which is like, you know, or like if, you know, if you've ever been on like a bike ride and you get like a little gnat in your eye and you're like, oh, what if that little gnat gets in there and then it
little demon bug
trickles up to your brain?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
That'd be so fun. That actually would be such a fun way to like start a horror movie where it's just people, a family out for a bike ride and just, you know, that's such a common thing. Like, ah, you know, and then the kids start acting really weird and then- And they just like can't trace it back, but you as the viewer know, like there was this one naughty little gnat.
I know, I have, that's funny. For a possible upcoming Nightmare Fuel, I have had this recurring thought of a little bug that is not of this world that infects you.
It could go in your ear?
Mm-hmm, like a little—
climb up your butthole?
Demonic type little bug.
Can it please go in your butthole?
Yeah, it could.
That's such a funny thing. All right, well, are you ready for another one?
I am.
Okay, we're off to Ireland. Hey there, guys. Here's my story about—
will you do this one in an Irish accent, please?
I will not.
Oh, okay.
I don't do accents because I don't have an ear for language, as they say. So if I'm around it for a really long time, I will start to like pick it up just kind of naturally, like in my sponge-like manner. But
oh, will you now? I wasn't very good. That was supposed to be Irish, but it wasn't very good.
Yeah, see, exactly.
I also don't have an ear for language.
I'm just imagining Kyler's flying to Dublin tomorrow. He's off on a trip with his friends and—
oh, hello there. Like just some crazy like
that's not
caricature
even,
of an old-timey Irish accent.
But Kyler gets so into places.
I can see him starting to talk with an Irish
accent. Oh, yeah. It was like he's been in Germany for a week and he already isn't saying Munich, but he's like writing München. And I'm like, buddy, you're in Munich, okay?
We are heading to München tomorrow.
Wow, you're really good.
I know, it's a gift.
Wow, unbelievable. Did you learn that at finishing school?
I did. Wow. We had a language course.
You did?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You did all languages or just?
Most of them, like 25, 30 of them, something like
and
that.
And you can speak all of them fluently?
Oh, yeah. I can do the accent fluently.
Oh, okay. But the language is a little.
Mm-hmm. We learned that it's customary when you're in another country to mimic their accent.
Oh, yeah. They like that?
Mm-hmm. Yep, they find it endearing.
Do you want to give us any examples before I move on? Or do you want to think about it and save it for the end of the show?
I don't know.
Oh, you're laughing. Okay, fine. I was taking it very seriously. Hey there, guys. Here's my story about growing up in my home in Ireland. I grew up in an old home in Ireland, a small bungalow in an old part of the town by the east coast of Ireland, where I still live to this day. It was myself, my dad, my mother, and my older sister. When I was young, I always had nightmares and saw things in the dark. I never really had proper, restful sleep, and then it would be followed by periods of insomnia. I couldn't look at the posters in my room as my mind made it seem like they were talking to me. I wouldn't hear anything, but I'd see them move their mouths as if they were trying to tell me something. As I often tried to drift off to sleep, I'd swear I'd see something moving. My nights were full of me being on high alert until I eventually passed out from the exhaustion of it all. I often heard sounds in the night as well. It could be a simple, soft knock or a gentle scratch. Sometimes it would escalate and sounded like someone flicking the side of an empty wine glass over and over. If I raised my head from the pillows, these sounds would stop at once. But as I laid my head back down and was about to fall asleep, I would hear them once again, keeping me up and in a state of fear all night. One night, when I was somewhere between 7 and 9, I felt particularly off. No matter where I looked in my room, I felt unsafe. I desperately needed to sleep as I had school early in the morning. My bed was in the corner of the room, and I decided if I turned around and stared at the wall instead, I wouldn't see anything and I would find sleep. Success, I thought, as calm washed over me. But then I heard it. It started off in a low whisper. I stayed staring at the wall, convincing myself that what I was hearing was just something else. But it grew louder and louder until I was able to make out the words. In a ghastly voice, I heard someone saying over and over, "Get into your bed." It repeated itself, growing louder with each command. I continued to ignore it as best I could, bringing the duvet up to hide my face. It only grew louder until I could not ignore it anymore. I looked over my shoulder and there it was, a large shadow mass in the shape of a man standing over my bed. It was right by my head, looming over me, but not looking at me. Just standing there and looking straight forward. Was it even aware of me? My ear was ringing with intense pain as the scream to get into bed seemed to be blasted at full volume. I let out a scream of pure fear, eventually waking my parents. The moment I got up and turned my light on, of course, the figure was gone. My parents let me sleep with them that night and chalked it up to a bad nightmare. I actually agreed with my parents, until one night when my friend slept over. We were about 10, having a sleepover at my house. We stayed up late, playing PlayStation games in the dark. We thought it would be fun to play hide-and-go-seek in my dark room. My room was fairly large, so one person would wait by the light switch and count, while the other one would hide somewhere in the room, whether it be in the corner, covered by a blanket, or under the bed, and so on. Realistically, there were not that many places to hide, but that didn't keep us kids from having a good laugh. It was my time to hide. I grabbed my duvet and was going to hide between my bed and my closet when I saw it. The light coming through my bedroom window revealed a hand on the wall, then another hand, then an arm, then a body, then a face. It was the face of an old woman with eyes full of hatred and anger. Her outstretched hands were coming right towards me. I screamed for my friend to turn on the light. He turned around and he saw it too, this mask coming up off the wall, coming at me full of anger. He was screaming that he couldn't find the light switch as we both began crying out for help. My friend eventually found the light switch, and the moment he turned it on, the figure disappeared. I no longer dream at night, I no longer have nightmares, and I have no trouble sleeping like a bear. At 27, I've moved back home with my parents just for a short span as I save money to get my own place. One night, after listening to your podcast, I mentioned these childhood stories to my mother casually in conversation while we were eating dinner. She froze and then told me to repeat these stories once more, giving me her full attention. She then informed me that as a kid, my sister, whose room was across from mine, was also hearing noises, scratches, and the like, and that her wardrobe doors and closet doors were opening by themselves and lights were being turned on without anyone switching them on. My mother eventually went into my sister's room when no one was home and shouted at the spirit that it was not welcome and that it had to leave our house. She then had a priest come and bless the house as well. My mother, sharing my sister's stories, brought some validity to what I experienced as a child, but that just makes the situation a whole lot worse. I still get chills thinking about it. Gabriel.
I bet, Gabriel.
Yeah.
I thought that was going to take a different turn for whatever reason, or just my mind went different when they brought up their mom.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking as a parent, how bad you'd feel if like your kid or kids are complaining about like, you know, we were seeing this old lady or whatever, this entity in their room. And you're like, no, it's just your imagination. No, that didn't happen. And then like years later, you see it.
Oh man.
Or you find like more witness cooperation. It's like, oh, it feels so bad.
I mean, actually just thinking about like Monroe, where her bedroom is, there's a giant tree in our front yard.
Oh, yeah.
And she would be freaked out. And like, we were always like, oh, it's just the tree, like, you know, close the curtains or whatever. But then all these years later, I would talk about hearing something in the house in Kyler's room. Momo.
Yeah, maybe she was hearing the same thing or something.
Thought
it was the tree.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because she would like say like it was like scraping the window. You know, that's a very specific sound, a tree branch hitting a window. It's like uber specific.
And I don't think that tree, those branches shouldn't reach the window, not even close.
Whoopsies. Listen, when you're a tired parent— Okay.
Right.
When you're just like, please go to sleep. Please. I just want to get the laundry done and go to bed myself. That's all you want.
Yep.
You just want to get to bed. Little stinkers. And then you wish for it later. I know. She doesn't want me to come in her room and snuggle anymore.
It's nope.
Really upsetting. Oh, okay. You ready for one more?
Yeah.
My nose, I keep feeling
a sneeze.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I can feel the tickle. Hello, Dan and Lindsay.
Hello.
Hello. I've been meaning to share my story with you guys, but, you know, work gets in the way. Anyway, my story happened when I was 16. I was living in Jakarta, Indonesia at the time and was seeing this guy during the summer holidays. We were all third culture kids and went to an international school in Jakarta. Most of us in the story are of mixed race descent, half European or something else and the other half Indonesian. We all speak Indonesian and are all familiar with the Indonesian culture and superstitions. So, 2006, I was seeing this guy, Andy. He seemed nice enough. Long story short, that summer involved a number of weird ghost hunting activities initiated by Andy and his pals, and it would later bite him in the ass. One day, we were talking about haunted places in and around Jakarta, and one of the guys mentioned there's this area called Hambalang. It was a sort of super housing complex project that had its own mall, sports facility, etc. Kind of like an exclusive town all of its own. This project had started a few years before, but the company went bankrupt and they never finished. The streets, the layout, and the structures of the houses were already built, but the homes didn't have windows, roofs, or doors.
Creepy.
One of Andy's friends, Danny, suggested we drive through this empty ghost town and see what we find there. Stupidly, five of us decided to go along with Danny, who drove. The roads in the complex were just gravel, and the grass was all tall and unkept. There was a barricade, but it was just hanging off to one side. Clearly, other people had already gone into ghost hunt or do whatever. Once we passed the barricade, it was like driving through a scene of Resident Evil. Complete darkness, except for the moonlight. Danny, who is a poster child for toxic masculinity, rolled down his windows and kept shouting out things like, if I see a Kuntalana, I'm going to ask her to suck my dick. Kuntalanas are the spirits of women who've died while pregnant. He also said that nothing would ever happen to him because his parents, quote, passed down a power to him called White Tiger. Why I ever associated with this creep, I'll never know. It's so cringy to think about now. As I looked out the window, I saw a flash of something in one of the houses. I kept it to myself and immediately looked down at the floor of the car. I planned to keep looking down until we left Hombolong. I was so freaked out and felt so uneasy that I was repeatedly saying things in my head like, I'm really sorry. We didn't mean to disturb anyone or anything. Anyway, we eventually left, drove back to the city, and that was it. Hombolong was a bit of an unsuccessful ghost hunt. A few days later, Andy rang me at 2 a.m., completely scared and stuttering. He told me he was hiding under the covers because there was something in his room. He could just feel it. He kept saying that he could feel something looking at him, but he didn't know how to explain what it was. This went on for 30 minutes until he eventually decided to ring his ustad. Andy is a Muslim, and I was raised Catholic, so I guess an ustad is the equivalent of your local pastor or priest. He had me on his cordless phone and then used his mobile to ring the ustad on a speaker. He told the ustad what he told me, that there was something in his room and he could feel its presence and it was making him very uneasy and giving him cold sweats. The ustad asked him, Andy, did you and your friends go looking for trouble recently? Andy then told him about how he went to Hombolong a few days before that. And then the ustad said, Andy, I can sense there is a spirit of a young woman in your room who maybe doesn't know she's dead yet because she died tragically in a car accident. The accident must have happened somewhere near Hombolong. If it was her and her boyfriend survived the accident. And here's the thing, Andy, you look just like him. She must have followed you back. The ustad then told Andy that he would spend the rest of the morning praying for this woman's spirit and told Andy to recite some of his own prayers. I could hear Andy repeating his Bismillah prayer over and over. He said he felt better and would call me if anything changed. When I heard all of this from the other line, I started to freak out. All these thoughts started running through my head like, what if she knew Andy and I were seeing each other? Would she come for me next? Thankfully, I didn't experience anything and life for me was as normal as usual. One of the other guys said he started experiencing some strange poltergeist activity, like his watch would go missing and then he'd find it in the garden a few days later. Like many teenage friendships, it all fizzled out and we didn't really hang out with each other much after that summer. 7 years after that incident, Andy and I caught up over drinks, and of course the story came up. He said he still remembers that moment and feeling so very clearly, and that he'll never forget it as long as he lives. I have never gone ghost hunting since, and I don't intend to put myself through that kind of anxiety again. I just live vicariously through your podcast and horror movies. Kay.
Thanks, Kay.
And then just like a real, I was like so curious about the Kuntalanak. Okay, so according to the web, she's a well-known and infamous ghost in the Indonesian and Malaysian cultures. The vampire, she's a vampire with long hair and white clothes, and is not only infamous for securing men, but also preying on newborn babies and feasting on female blood and placentas.
Yee.
So fucking creepy. And is also the Kuntalanak, we've also heard of her, is called the Pontianak, usually takes the form of a pregnant woman who's unable to give birth to a child.
Huh.
And I know that we've had the Pontianak in somewhere.
I know we've been to Indonesia in some of my stories. I don't remember that entity, but maybe.
Or maybe I'm saying it's Pontianak, or maybe I'm saying it incorrectly and it's just not. But I have vague recollections of some other Indonesian tale with her there.
Yeah, I would love to go to Indonesia someday.
Let's go.
I think Jakarta is like a pretty futuristic type city, like very, very modern in parts.
I know nothing about it, but I'm down for any adventure.
Yeah, I want to say like Indonesia, like tech-wise and just like as far as like architecture and stuff, if I'm just pulling this out of my memory bank right now, but just like—
You have a good memory.
But I, Yeah, just like really crazy, like skyscrapers, and just kind of like in what is it, Qatar, in some places, in like around the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, where it's just like so futuristic,
yeah,
and just like so much money put into these like, you know, commercial and residential developments that just look like, how is that on Earth now?
Right, right.
You know, just compared to what we have now, it's like it feels like they're like decades ahead.
Where is it that there's that like indoor, I think it's in Qatar or...
Yeah, Qatar.
But it's like a, I remember seeing this, maybe it was on social media, maybe it was here, but it's like or maybe Monroe showed us. It's like an indoor like mall, I'm going to call it, but it's like apartments and everything. Then there's like a train that runs through the middle of it. And so it's like, you like leave your apartment and you step onto this train.
That's designed for, it hasn't been built yet.
Concept.
I can't remember which country it is. It's somewhere in the Middle East. Maybe it's Qatar, but yeah, it's this crazy new type of city that they were going to like build in the desert where it's just, like a big line.
Yeah.
And it's not like in a canyon or anything. Like they could, you know, build out, but they're just like planning for transport and stuff. And they have these like high speed, like basically subway system that just goes back and forth. Mm-hmm. And I imagine on a couple of different tracks and everything is built along that. So it's just
like
very
all
narrow.
Inside because it's the desert and it's like scorching.
Yeah.
So it's like, you're like in, so I don't know. It's so hard to explain because I can't.
I don't remember the inside part, but maybe the big chunk of it is. Yeah, but they have some like plans for like designing some new cities.
Yeah.
That look like it might as well be on Mars or something.
So wild.
Yeah.
I was telling Dan, this is just a random thing, but just look up California Forever. That's like a wild thing where these like billionaires, these tech billionaires are trying to just build a new city by buying up a bunch of farmland outside of San Francisco. And I haven't seen any plans or anything, but I just listened to a podcast about it and I was like, say what now? Mm-hmm. Like if we had like an endless amount of money, we could just go buy a fuck ton of acreage somewhere and just build a brand new city with brand new infrastructure.
Yeah.
Just that's, I
you
can't
know who's
accept
doing that.
That
right now.
I don't.
Disney. Have you heard of these Disney communities?
Yes. But I didn't know. But are they building like a new city? Like a standalone?
Like, yeah. It's like basically the one I looked at was out in the desert somewhere.
Whoa.
From what I understand, all of the infrastructure within the city runs essentially on like Disney bucks. Huh? So if you get employed there, you earn your Disney bucks and then you would spend it. It's like all
true company
licensed
town.
By Disney. You can't buy anything that isn't Disney in that.
Oh
my God. It's kind of a weird, you have to look up what they're called, but I know they're planning still like in the stages of like a handful of them.
We used to have those places here in this country. There's plenty of cities across America that were once true company towns where it's like, it would be a mine or a series of like mills
or
something.
Okay, that makes sense.
Sometimes just like a planned community based on like religious ideals. And
that's called a cult or a compound.
Compound, but it would be like a town, like in the 19th century, you know? And it's like, it's just weird here now to think about like a new city because we haven't had that happen in so long.
Yeah, it's hard for me to accept.
But yeah, like you know, during westward expansion, it was all like these boom towns.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Based usually off like, you know, sometimes off of timber, but mostly off of mining of some sort. And then a town would grow up. And then the railway would come to connect like this mining town with some other major like port city or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be like new towns springing up as basically like supply stops along that
line.
Along
the way, yeah.
I mean, even I think like, you know, like Riggins, right, group, I think it was, you know, there in that along that canyon, maybe not Riggins because there was a site of a sawmill and the convergence of like the Little Salmon and the Big Salmon, but there'd be other towns in like communities like Lucille, these little places that would be basically based on how far could you get on a horse in one day.
Wow.
And
so
then
crazy.
And then somebody would set up like a stagecoach or whatever, and then a little town would spring up, and then like another town would extend like another day's travel from that town. But
it's
you don't hear
so
about that anymore.
Well, right, because it's like, because
we have all the towns.
We have all the modes of transportation.
Yeah.
We have drones delivering packages. Like it doesn't, I mean, this California for everything, this wasn't a very in-depth podcast. It was like 35 minutes, but it's like somewhat of a response to like the housing crisis.
Mm, yeah.
So, you know, they have like a different like motivation. There's various other things. I'm not going to get into the politics of it, but it's just so crazy to think about like, okay, where we live, there's a lot of expansion and growth, you know, just from the time that we moved here till now. It's like that stretch of freeway used to just be nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like storage unit, apartment building, housing complex, housing, like it's fucking crazy. But it's not like somebody just came in and like bought and then just like a town sprung up.
Yeah.
Like I can't accept that like there would be nothing and now there's a whole town.
Yeah, the close.
Like, where do you live? Oh, in San Bubo. And they're like, what? I've never heard of that. Oh, it's new.
Established 2024.
Right. That's like, I can't. My brain does not accept it. So strange.
I did think, before we do the Annabelles and stuff, I did think of an accent that I'd be comfortable like right now. Like if I was traveling to like Russia and I was in St. Petersburg or Moscow and I wanted to like let the locals know that I appreciated their culture.
No, and again, this is like from finishing school.
And this would just be an endearing thing. Like if you want locals to like you, and you can't speak their language, you can at least speak like you have their accent if they were speaking your language. That is what I've heard from finishing school teachers, that they really appreciate and just, you know, and they like you so much more.
And so were you an expert? Was Russian like your favorite?
It's just the one I happened to pop in my head now. I did study quite a bit on it. But if I was in Russia and I wanted people to like me, I would just go to Russians and be like, where do you have borscht? I like beets very much. I would like a doll with little doll inside with smaller doll, happy to pay ticket for Dancing Bear on bicycle. And they would be like, oh, he knows a lot about our culture and he's taken the time to at least understand our accent.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep. The more you know.
Ring. Wow. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. I feel so much more worldly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You're cultured now.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to do some shout outs?
Yeah.
Sorry. Now my brain is that Russia's having their election this weekend. And I'm thinking about Alexei Navalny. My brain went to a completely different place. I thought you were going to tell a different story.
I'll thank the following Annabelles.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much for supporting this show. Chacon. Or Chacon Brown, I'm going to say Chacon Brown, William McConnell, Lou Sassel, Tristan Hart, A.D. Chapin. It's like Aiden, but with like two E's instead of a E-N.
Wait, A-D-D-I-E?
A-I-D-E-E.
A-I-D-E-E. Addie?
Maybe Addie. Addie Chapin. Manfred. This is not a real name. Manfred von Tittybeans das Poop.
Could you say that in Russian?
Well, it's more of a German name.
Can you say that with a German accent?
Of course. Of course. Manfred von Tittybeans das Poop is a very endearing German accent.
That's lovely.
Where is your bratwurst? I love your German thing, zings. Yeah. Zings. I love your German zings.
So good. I'm like just flabbergasted.
Yeah, it's a real talent. Oof. Sanaya Wilson, Jonathan King, Rachel, and Magic.
Magic. Mm-hmm. I would like to thank the following Annabelles. I will only be using my English accent, my American accent. Alexa Simpkins, Han Key, Crystal Luther, Moises, James Keith Roberts, David Dickens, Keith Connellan, Jade Smith, The Little Pisces, and Teresa Renner. Are you related to Jeremy? and then I just have a few swoopy shout outs. Cool?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
To Dalton from Darcy, happy birthday. To Melinda from Melinda, happy birthday to me. And to Kirsten from Peter, you are the most amazing person I've ever met. Thank you for being the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Aww.
So sweet.
Now I had that Ray LaMontagne, one of our wedding songs. You are the best thing. Okay, that's our show.
Did you learn how to sing in finishing school?
I did. I learned how to do music with my mouth.
Wow.
So a lot of people can sing. They might be like, you are the best thing. But what they can't do is like, that is a lot. It takes a lot more practice.
Do you have a favorite instrument or musical sound that you like to make with your mouth?
The air banjo. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's excellent.
I've been playing that a long time.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Are you professional?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Cool.
That's our show. I hope you learned a lot.
I learned things about you that I didn't even know I didn't know. So this was eye-opening. And I feel a little less than, you know?
You should. Because you haven't been to finishing school like I have. You've learned so many things that are important.
Okay, I'll work on it.
That's our show. Thanks for continuing to send in your personal tales of terror to mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email us for everything else, including finishing school information, at info@scaredtodeathpodcast.com.
Do you think finishing school should get its own email where people can submit finishing school questions?
Oh, God, no. Thanks to Logan Keith.
So great.
Thanks to Logan Keith for editing and publishing today's show. Thanks to Heather Rylander organizing the My Story emails. To book editor Drew Atana, polishing and preparing listener stories for book number 5. Thank you to producer Sophie Evans, finding the first story I told this week, and Olivia Lee, once again for finding the second. We are on YouTube if you want to watch the show, on Facebook and Instagram, where we post pics that accompany episodes and more at Scared to Death Podcast. We also have a private Facebook group, Creeps and Peepers, full of fellow horror lovers. Big thanks to the all-seeing eyes, the Creeps and Peepers moderators, who continue to be fantastic. Enjoy your nightmares, Creeps and Peepers. Hope you were scared to death.
Bye.
If spirits threaten me in this place, fight water by water and fire by fire. Banish their souls into nothingness and remove their powers until the last trace. Let these evil beings flee through time and space. Evil may pass through, but have no home here within, scared to death.
Mad Magic Productions.
It could go in your ear.
Mm-hmm. Like a little...
climb up your butthole.
Demonic type little bug.
Mm-hmm. Can it please go in your butthole?
Yeah, it could.
That was such a funny thing.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Next, don't give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it?
Let's go, give it to you.
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up.
Order now at Acura.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.